It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk with a UW professor about what life is like as a vocal scholar activist.
First, President Obama announced today that companies with more than 100 employees will soon need to report what they pay their employees by race, gender, and ethnicity.
The announcement comes on the 7th anniversary of the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. It builds on the president's efforts to address the pay gap between men and women.
Here's the president explaining why he's pushing for this change and why the gender gap in wages is a problem.
And it means that women are not getting the fair shot that we believe every single American deserves. It doesn't just offend our values at a time when women are increasingly the breadwinners in our households. Paying them less makes it harder for families to cover the necessities like childcare or health care, just to pay the bills.
Joining us now to give us the latest on the announcement is Edward Isaac Dover, senior White House reporter for Politico. Isaac, thanks for joining us. Well, talk us through what the president is announcing, what changes under this executive action.
Well, so the big thing is that he has put into place something now that will require companies that have more than 100 employees to report data about salaries based on or classified by gender, race, and ethnicity. So they won't necessarily be saying how much each person earns, but that they will be saying this is how much men earn on average, this is how much women earn. It's not clear exactly how deep the breakdown will be, whether it'll be an overall thing or that we'll know position by position. At some point that becomes private data. But the president has put that into place, and he's also used today as a time to remember the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which was the first thing that he signed into law when he was a very new president in 2009, that was about combating pay discrimination for women. And also making a push, even though he knows very well that Congress is not likely to take him up on the offer to pass what's called the Paycheck Fairness Act. And that would extend the protections that are in place to make sure that people are getting paid the same no matter what their gender is, their ethnicity, their race, all that stuff.
And you mentioned the Lilly Ledbetter Act passed by Congress and the president early in his term. Obviously, if they're still taking executive actions now, there's a sense that that fell short. So why? Why is there a sense that that didn't fix all that it was supposed to fix?
Well, it was, the president would say, a first step in this, and that there is a need to continue to expand the protections that are there and the oversight that is there, because the Ledbetter Act made some progress, but there was then, in 2014, the president signed an executive action requiring that all federal contractors have an equal pay structure, and then this measure today with the requiring companies to put their data out there is another step forward in this. And of course, the Paycheck Fairness Act, were it to ever get passed, would be more along these lines. But this is not. Few of these things have happened without a lot of pushback. The pushback not being that people are saying women should make less money than men, but that people think that this is not the right way to approach it, and it's too much government intervention into private companies anyway.
And all this really changes, as I understand it, is data collection right now. So the hope from the White House is once they have these numbers, they can see what the scope is of discrimination, and that's going to help help solve problems?
Well, not just once the White House or the government has it, but if you imagine that this data could be accessible and that women who might suspect that they're getting paid less than men would be able to either have that verified or contradicted by the data, that could change how this goes. You know, if you go back to Lilly Ledbetter, who was an employee for was over 20 years, or almost 20 years, and she only found out that there was some issue with her pay compared to her male coworkers based on an anonymous message that she got. So she doesn't even know where it came from, but somebody flagged it for her, and then she began to look into it. So what you have is a situation now where there are a lot of women who wonder whether they're getting paid less than their male counterparts. They know that the general statistics are out there that men, that women make 79 cents to a dollar that men make on average, and they will theoretically, with this data push, be able to see whether that applies to their workplace.
We're talking to Edward Isaac Dover. He's senior White House reporter for Politico, looking at executive action at the White House today on equal pay issues by gender. Now let's get into the politics. Isaac, you wrote about that 2014 action and said, yeah, there's a substantive policy thing here, but also it came at a time, a political time, a part of an effort to help Democrats in the congressional races. Do you see a similar thing this time around? This is an issue that might be important, say, in the presidential race.
Sure, because the box that the president gladly puts Republicans into here is having them oppose what he's doing based on their political principle, saying that they think there's another way to do it. But what he hopes that, and Democrats overall hope this looks like to people, is that the Republicans are saying that they're just not for equal pay. And obviously there's a political advantage in that if they can make people believe that that's true.
And part of the Republican argument, especially for the action he's looking for in Congress, that Paycheck Protection Act, I think it was called, is Fairness Act, I'm sorry, yep. Thank you. Is that it's going to open the door to lawsuits. They're saying this is a trial lawyer enhancement act, in effect.
Right, exactly. And that's one of the things that often comes up in this, that you see the arguments largely about, not on the principle of equal pay versus unequal pay, but the method of doing it, which seems like they will create a large government intervention into private business, they'll create lawsuits, and that some of those lawsuits may not be well-justified lawsuits, but that the people that would be the proposed beneficiaries of these laws wouldn't see the gains of it so much as the trial lawyers themselves would.
Staying with the politics of all this for a moment, I've heard analysis that the Republican Party, to win the presidency this year, needs to improve its performance among women voters. This could be an issue that affects them. It's an even bigger issue if you end up with something like, people have said, a Hillary Clinton against Donald Trump general election. Are women going to be a really contested, working women in particular, a contested category for both parties?
Certainly, and look, though Bernie Sanders is still a possibility as the nominee for the Democrats, most people would still put the money on Hillary Clinton being the nominee. If she is the nominee, if she's running for November, you will hear her continue, as she has already talked about, the importance of women's issues and taking care of those issues, not just because she's a woman, but because she's a Democrat and Democrats believe in it, and that's how this feeds into it. But yeah, because she's a woman, and she would potentially be the first female president. The interesting thing about the way that the polling data comes in on the equal pay stuff is that it doesn't only turn women. And the Democrats were finding in 2014 that there were men who were responding to it too, basically middle-class, working-class men who were from two-income families where both the man and the woman, the husband and the wife, were working. And they were feeling like, hey, we could have more money in our joint bank account if my wife was making more. Now, it obviously resonates more for women than it does for men, even among those that group. But it's not just women who the Democrats feel like they can appeal to on this issue.
We'll leave it there. Isaac, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was White House reporter Edward Isaac Dover from Politico giving us the latest on President Obama's push to bridge the pay gap between men and women.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
So if you're on Twitter and you follow Wisconsin News, you've probably heard of UW Education Policy Professor Sarah Goldrick Rabb. She has a reputation as a prolific tweeter, and she's been a lightning rod for both devotion and criticism. Her public battle with policy leaders over changes to the UW system's tenure system was covered in the New York Times. After criticism that she'd crossed a line by seeking out incoming UW students on Twitter to make her case against the tenure changes.
On the other hand, her reputation for taking an active stance to make real-world changes based on solid research has drawn praise, earned her a national reputation among students and faculty. Some of her best-known passions include the mission to make college affordable and universal public higher education. In that work, she identified as a scholar activist, and she teaches a course on the subject.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb joins us now. She's a professor of educational policy studies and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she's the founder of the Wisconsin Hope Lab on college affordability. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Well, there's a quote on your Twitter page that I want to start with, and it says, "I am no longer accepting the things I cannot change. I am changing the things I cannot accept." How does that kind of sum up the last year for you and your fight against these tenure changes we were talking about, and also the coming years and your push for college affordability?
Well, first of all, that's a quote from Angela Davis, who's actually one of my heroes. I would say that, you know, what the last year has been about is doing something about the world that we're all confronting today, which is accompanied and characterized by a lot of changes to our lives here in Wisconsin that many of us have felt powerless over. And it's pretty common to watch things go by, watch political decisions, watch changes about our jobs and our families' lives happen and feel like we don't have input into it. And I felt that it was time to stand up and make our opinions known about what has been going on in this state, which I think many of the decisions don't actually reflect the preferences of the families around the state. And so in this case, you know, over the last year, I have been speaking out about our right to an affordable higher education in the state, something I know people care about, and our right as educators to interact with our students on a fair and open and honest basis, which is something that requires tenure.
So is that, in essence, do you think what it means for you to be a scholar activist, or is that what it just means to you to be a citizen?
I think it's both. I think that's a really good question, although I think that sometimes professors are assumed to be public figures who aren't allowed to have private lives as citizens. You know, scholar activism to me, in a sense, is just calling out what a true scholar has always been about, which is about learning about the world, studying the world, and then taking that knowledge and using it to try to improve people's lives. In other words, acting on what we've learned. And that's exactly what I've been trying to do for the past 11 years here in Wisconsin. I take very seriously the idea that my work is important and is funded by the taxpayers of the state precisely because it is meant to be translated into things that can improve their lives. And one of those things is making college more affordable and accessible.
And going back to last year now, it was an intense year for you. In lots of ways, you were a mouthpiece, one of several, but a mouthpiece for the fight against UW System's tenure changes. You were on Twitter a lot. There was a prolific Twitter account going on with you, and you were very vocal, as you said, about how you felt. What was your relationship with Twitter back then, and did it accomplish what you wanted to, short of actually, I guess, reversing those tenure changes?
Yeah, I mean, Twitter can serve, for those of you who are not on it, it's important to know it can serve a couple of different mechanisms. And in many ways, what it tries to do are things you do in your regular life anyway, but you're doing it on a bigger scale. So, for example, I'm certain that everyone has experienced walking around somewhere and somebody hands you a flyer. And what that flyer is a piece of paper containing information that the person handing it to you wants you to know about. Tweeting can be similar to flyering, meaning, hey, Veronica, I want you to know about this, and I send you a link. Right? That's one form of tweeting. Another form of tweeting is a conversational form where you're having a back and forth discussion with someone else. And while you could do that with your neighbor, what Twitter allows you to do is essentially broaden the set of neighbors that you could have conversations with because you can do it with lots of different people, including people you wouldn't normally get to meet. What I was trying to do around the tenure issue was both things. Number one, I was trying to essentially flyer the world with information about the fact that there were major changes happening to tenure in Wisconsin that affected our lives, the people of the state, and frankly, professors all over the country and the students they educate. I was also trying to have conversations with people about it because I believe, as an educator, that we learn through conversation. And both of those things were happening at once.
We're talking with UW's Sarah Goldrick-Rabb right now. She's a professor of educational policy studies and sociology here at UW-Madison, and she's also the founder of the Wisconsin Hope Lab on college affordability. Now, looking back again at that kind of maelstrom of last year, you were the center of a lot of media attention. Some of that was critical. I've read that your staff was threatened. People actually said mean stuff about your hair. How did that change what it felt like to you to be a prominent faculty member at UW?
To be honest, I can't say that it didn't hurt. I wouldn't be human if I said it didn't hurt. At the same time, you know, taking a stand on an issue always makes you subject to critique. And I think it's better to have aired concerns on this topic, a topic that has, become just so important to the lives of so many people, than to have said nothing at all. It was disheartening to me at an institution that prides itself on being a home to what we call sifting and winnowing, meaning discussion about anything and everything with the attempt to get to the truth. It was disheartening to feel that my right to have that opinion and to air that opinion, both in terms of conversation and in terms of equivalent of leafleting or flyering by sending out information, that was not fully supported by the administration here or by the faculty here.
Now, moving on, that's more or less behind you. You're carrying some of it with you, but you're focusing a lot now on the work of the Hope Lab and those issues of college affordability, and you've been calling for universal public higher education. How are you using your stance now as a scholar activist, like we were talking about, to urge change in that direction?
Well, I have been speaking with Wisconsin families now for more than a decade about their concerns about the high and rising price of college. And to be honest, even the discussion about tenure is a discussion about affordability. One of the reasons tenure is so important is that faculty have to be able to speak out when administrators are making changes to the institution that make it more expensive. I have been speaking out about my concerns about UW-Madison's changes, including raising tuition and its rising cost of attendance, for years, and it's been one of the reasons tenure has been so important. So this actually isn't a change for me. It's a continuation of continuing to try to represent the interests of Wisconsin families in making college more affordable. The Wisconsin Hope Lab is an effort to find the best ways to do that. And what we can tell from listening to students and families is that the current system is not doing its job. It can't accomplish the goals it was set out to do. And I'm trying to say very clearly to folks that it's time to take seriously how broken this system is, and to do something about it. It's hard to shake people from the status quo. It's hard to convince people it is possible to pay for education in a different manner that can make it all less expensive for us on an individual basis. But we have to try, because so many people out there are being locked out of opportunities for education, not because they lack talent, but because they lack money.
Well, the governor recently put out a package of bills for improving college affordability. It had things in it like emergency grants, financial literacy training, internship opportunities. What is your take on that plan?
I'm really glad you brought it up, because I think there are a lot of people who are surprised to hear me say I like it. And I like it because it includes some very fine policy ideas, including those that I and my team have been working together on for the last couple of years. Emergency financial aid is an innovation. It's an innovation that says the current financial aid system often delivers money sort of too late or at the wrong timing for students, and doesn't catch them when, for example, the car broke down and they don't have quite enough money to fix it, so they don't come to class. This is something a lot of folks have been looking at over time, and I was really glad to see Governor Walker include that in his proposals. Now, Do I wish that, for example, he was looking at models that would include making public higher education less expensive overall and raising financial aid more substantially? Of course. But I don't harbor those expectations given his stated goals and policy decisions to date. So I think this was a very reasonable proposal, and I came out immediately in support of it.
As we wrap up, in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, I read that you're thinking about leaving UW for another out-of-state offer. As you weigh that decision, what kinds of things are you thinking about in terms of kind of what went wrong and maybe pieces you were disillusioned with and pieces you would be sad to leave?
You know, to be honest, I mean, what I think about are those Wisconsin students and families. I have spent an enormous amount of time over the last decade getting to know this state, both through my research and my teaching, as well as raising two young children here. I love this place. I intended to remain here until I retired. I am no longer thinking of doing so, and there is only one reason for it, and that is Act 55, which was passed last summer. I remember the moment it was announced on May 29th. It was a stunning moment when I realized that a state that had invested so much in its public higher education system was going to allow for it to be undermined by removing the protections for its educators.
Sarah,
and that is, in fact, what's happened.
Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Sarah Goldrick-Rabb of the UW-Madison and founder of the Wisconsin Hope Lab on college affordability.
Stick around. There's more to come up. Come on Central Time. Food Friday is next after the news.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Brunch is a weekend meal mainstay. It turns out a pretty American phenomenon. Whether you tend toward the sweet stuff like French toast or pancakes or savory dishes like Eggs Benedict or quiche, brunch gives us a chance to enjoy a leisurely meal, often with friends and family.
Well, joining us now are two Wisconsin brunch experts. We've got John Gato and Philip Hurley. They're the chefs and co-owners of Sardine and Marigold Kitchen in Madison, two of the city's brunch hotspots. Marigold Kitchen was voted 2015 Best of Madison Gold winner for Best Breakfast, according to a community-wide poll by Madison Magazine. John and Philip, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Philip, let's start with you. Are there any particular rules that you got to play by when we're talking about brunch?
Rules? That's a good question. We like to, I think it's first with brunch is that you come in with a good attitude because you're going to have fun. It's sort of that guilty pleasure of stretching the week on a little further than it normally would be. I think the rules should be start with some alcohol, a little cocktail, Bloody Mary or a salty dog or Greyhound. It seems to get things going pretty well for brunch. From there, it can kind of go up, keep going up.
And I know at your restaurants you stretched, well, it seems like in Madison until you showed up, there were not French fries, frites, served for breakfast. So thank you for that. Anything else you feel like you've done differently, John?
I think we've kind of put the signature on salad and French fries over at Sardine. I mean, it is a, you can kind of make anything into a brunch item if you put a salad next to it. Brunch is great for us because it fills in the gaps on the weekend. There's a psychology behind it, as Philip said. You know, people feel guilty, I think, if they have a Bloody Mary for brunch, but not so much, or for breakfast, but for brunch, it's a different story. We do savory things. Waffles and pancakes and that sort of thing. But our real sort of mainstay is egg dishes, something with an egg. Whether it's the baked creamed eggs or the duck confit salad that we put a poached egg on, and it's different takes on different types of meat with some sort of an egg and a salad that kind of complete the brunch.
If you put an egg on it, it's brunch.
Yeah. Yeah, in so many ways. Yeah.
Of course, you can do that with burgers, too, these days. You see a lot of that.
That's so true.
Is a burger with an egg on it brunch? I don't know.
You could certainly do that, yeah.
You can make the case.
Yeah.
And a brunch has really taken off. It almost seems like it's become this cultural phenomenon. I mean, beyond the food, people are in a lot of cases just nuts about brunch among all other meals. It's a social event too. Why do you think that is, Philip?
I think it's an opportunity. It's not as formal as going out to dinner or making a plan. And there's a sense of, I think, community that sort of happens with brunch. At least it does in our places, where you show up, you can bring your kids, you're still in the place that served you a great meal maybe an evening ago. But there's a certain relaxed attitude that comes with brunch that I think is sort of infectious for people. And there's a certain playfulness to it, where we hear all the time with Sardine and, of course, Marigold, oh, we just love when they're for brunch. And from our standpoint, brunch is great. We love it. It's great to fill the need. Dinner is sort of where the culinary seems to come out more, your talent. But brunch is the thing that people really remember at times because it is fun. And they're having drinks in the daytime on a Sunday, kind of stretching out that weekend. And I think that that sense of community and running into people and letting the kids kind of run around the tables, it's okay. So we're at dinner sometimes. Right. The parents don't feel that way. They feel a little bit more like, oh, you got to be a little bit more well-behaved or this. Not a brunch. It can be, it's a little bit more relaxed.
All bets are off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about some of the recipes. You gave us a couple, and they're both up on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're going to start with creamed eggs. These look delicious any time of day, actually. But yeah, you serve them, I guess, for brunch. Tell us about the creamed eggs, John.
Well, we start with, we use a dish that can withstand some heat, and we'll throw some prosciutto down, and then some heavy cream and a lot of Gruyere cheese,
and health food, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then spinach and then two eggs we crack in there, and then we bake it, and.
And we serve it with a little salad. Brunch.
This one, no French fries. Yeah, we put bread there instead.
But. So you feel a little virtuous because you've got your salad and your spinach and eggs are protein, so it's not all bad.
Yeah, that's the trick.
It's good stuff.
Salad can always make you feel okay about eating an extra French fry.
Right.
And you you stick it in the oven for how long?
Oh, on a pretty high heat for maybe 15 minutes or so. Yeah.
Philip, what do you like about the way that one comes together? You've got your prosciutto on the bottom. You've got cream. I'm kind of curious about the cream, actually. Does that just bake into the eggs?
Well, it does. It sort of thickens, and the cream will reduce a little bit when it's in there. And then when it mixes, it's like having a little fondue on your eggs. So it's
that
sort of decadent.
Okay.
And it's the type of thing that actually is good like a half an hour later if you're, it's because it's so hot when it comes out. It's sort of raw decadence, and it has this sort of... umami quality when you smell the Gruyere, coming up from me. It's got this very pungent sort of thing going on, and people love it. John put that on, I don't know, it might have been a couple of years ago, even now, and it's probably the most, talked about.
Really?
Yeah, it's sort of,
Well,
yeah. It's Food Friday, and we're talking with two brunch experts right now. We've got John Gatto and Philip Hurley of Sardine and Marigold Kitchen here in Madison, two of Madison's go-to brunch places. So we've got our eggs, we had our salad and our frites. So what about the pancakes and the waffles? Because that's another thing, basically dessert for breakfast, right? It's an excuse to eat dessert. How do you guys feel about, do you have a pancake philosophy?
Our philosophy is they have to be, we make them from scratch. They're delicious and... have to be, true to sort of a Wisconsin idea of what a great pancake would be, real maple syrup and, butter.
They're
light, too. Local.
They're a little lighter.
They're a little lighter.
They almost have a slight crepe-like quality to them.
Right, they're not the big fluff bombs that you can get sometimes. And I know some people like those, but these are a little more chewy. That's the way I like them. I think they're delicious. How do you get the texture a little bit more crepe-like, like you said?
Well, in this recipe, where there's a little yeast in there, so that may affect the batter in a way.
It's ratios, ratios.
Yeah.
Of Buttermilk and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's really the recipe. And I mean, we use, yeah, there's buttermilk, there's, you know, there's stuff that we use that's just basically local, and, you know, we make it from scratch.
Stuff we can't tell you.
Yeah.
It's very top secret.
Really?
Pancakes.
Oh, yeah. No, no.
Oh, darn. I was really hoping for the top secret stuff.
But yeah, they're talked about. They're good. I mean, we do a pretty good waffle over at Sardine too, as well.
You know, there are pancakes, as you were saying before, that can, there are some places I know in town that can accept, you know, any amount of syrup that you get put on them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These
right.
won't. For some reason, these won't. It kind of hits, and, you know, we've had enough, it's going to slide off.
Yeah, but we've talked about that, that some pancakes you can add the whole vat of syrup, and it seems
you can double the size of the pancake by adding more syrup and somehow maintain it.
Absorbs.
Ours don't. I think that's why they're not quite, you know, it shouldn't say gutman, but gutman. They can you know, you can have that and maybe something else, you know.
I like the idea of putting fruit on pancakes because, again, you get a little bit of something that's, you know, better for you, healthier for you.
Exactly.
It's all a charade.
Do you have any secrets for fooling ourselves with fruit or making maybe a little compote? How would you do something like that?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, you could, you know, you could take blueberries or strawberries or peaches or... You know, you can add some sugar and basically macerate them, you know, stir them around a little bit until they release their juice. And or you could take those same types of fruit and put them in a pan with a little bit of sugar and maybe even some booze. You could throw some some white wine in there and maybe some, you know, a cinnamon stick and that sort of thing. And then heat it up until it sort of breaks down a little bit and cool it off.
Do you chill it first, or do you like it to be kind of room temperature or warm?
You could do it room temp, or you could do it warm, either way.
Yeah. We tried, in the last few years, we've been purchasing a lot of berries, apricots, anything that we can in season, and we'll cook them off, and we'll can them, or we'll you know, vacuum pack them. So it's great that we're here in this part of the country where you have such great product that we can sort of bring back in a different form in the winter time. So we were just doing that last week. We had a beautiful apricot compote that we had from apricots from the summer. So
so it was nice in the dead of winter to remember what summer
tastes
like.
It is, yeah. Hope that spring will be here again.
We're talking right now with John Gatto and Philip Hurley of Sardine and Marigold Kitchen here in Madison. These are two of Madison's hot brunch places, and we're talking brunch for Food Friday.
I want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite brunch spot in Wisconsin? Are you a brunch fan? What do you look for in a great brunch? What has to be there on the table? Maybe you cook it yourself. What is your go-to for that weekly meal, the brunch? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page and find some recipes there, too. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our discussion now about brunch on today's edition of Food Friday. We've got John Gatto and Philip Hurley. They're the chefs and co-owners of Sardine and Marigold Kitchen in Madison.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a big fan of brunch? Or do you come down on sweet versus savory? Or do you want a little bit of both? Do you lean toward traditional favorites, or do you think it's a great time to experiment? What do you serve up when you make brunch at home? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
So we haven't talked yet about the other recipe that the two of you shared with us. This is another brunch classic. In this case, you're mixing it up a little, though. It's smoked salmon or lox. Philip, how do you use that one? Tell us about that sandwich.
That sort of came about just a sandwich that sort of encompasses what we think just you want. And, you know, instead of having a salad, put it between a couple pieces of bread, and it just works perfectly. And once again, there's egg in there, but it's a sliced hard-boiled egg. And there's this great mix of texture, and there's a little bit of a sweet sort of honey mustard dressing that's in there as well. The greens that get the watercress gets dressed in light citrus vinaigrette as well. And then, of course, the smoked salmon just is velvety and lush and just tastes great. That's sort of a favorite of mine when I go in there. I seem to sort of get drawn to that one. It's really good. hard to go around that.
Salad and French fries.
And there's a salad and French fries. You can't go too wrong, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you are kind of going a little rogue with that one, though, right? Because usually you've got your smoked salmon and some sort of bagel-type product and cream cheese. But you've got this whole delicious multi-layered sandwich going on. Does it feel like a breakfast thing or does it feel like an anytime thing?
I'd say it's anytime.
Yeah, exactly.
But it is perfect for brunch. It is. It's just sort of a lot of people actually have it without the bread these days, so they'll double the fries. Don't want the bread.
You'll have a mimosa with it if it's for brunch.
So do people say double the fries, hold the bread?
No, not really.
There's
times that we in the past where people were like, can you make sure they put enough fries on there? Yeah, as if we skimp on them.
Well, we haven't talked about those waffles. You mentioned those, and then we'll get to our callers at 800-642-1234. If you have a brunch question, an execution question, or just a comment, let us know at 800-642-1234. I've got a couple of brunch experts right here in the studio. And what about that? Waffles.
Let's go back to waffles. Waffles, okay.
Yeah, just silence. That's not good for radio,
is it? Waffles scare me.
They're so good, it's terrifying.
Well, we bought a really expensive waffle maker that keeps breaking down that we bought about,
fifth
10 years
waffle
ago.
Maker, yeah,
and it weighs like, half 100. A ton. Yeah. But, you know, they're crispy. They have great texture. And again, we use local maple syrup with that, and some sort of whipped butter. But generally, we use a compote with that too. And we try to stay seasonal, so we use some of the stuff that we've saved through the summer, whether it's blueberries or raspberries or blackberries. And we generally make a compote, and then the summer we'll use fresh stuff. But
are they yeasted, or do you just use baking powder, baking soda?
Those are yeasted. Yeah.
What's the difference then? What between that and the other?
A yeast will sort of it sort of binds things together. And we were talking about pancakes before, and I think it keeps the syrup from the pancakes from becoming too cakey. And
there's a flavor too. We make them ahead of time.
Yeah.
At least a day, and it's doing its thing, the yeast, and so it changes a little of the flavor profile as well.
Right.
Let's go to a caller now. We've got Travis joining us in Milwaukee. Travis, hi.
Hi, thank you. My question or comment is that my wife and I are very opposite with regards to brunch, where I love brunch and she does not. Her biggest complaint is the fact that people get up and get meals and then come back to the table at different timings. I tend to like the omelets with a lot of meat and things on them, such that I'm often at the brunch serving counter and waiting for my omelet while my wife has already gotten her fruit or something like that and moved on, and food gets cold waiting for the other people. Is there a way to make the coordinating the brunch people so that everybody is eating at the same time for a hot meal? Thanks
for that, Travis. It sounds like Travis is thinking of sort of a buffet scenario where you can, sometimes you go up and you can get your waffle made on site or your omelet drawn up in fancy brunch buffets. How about that? Have you guys ever thought about that?
Of
trying to time it out that everyone sits down with their hot plate of food at the same time.
Well, I mean, we do a la carte. So, people are ordering it and it all comes to the table at the same time.
But I know what Travis is saying. On vacation, it's kind of hard to find ourselves. They need a couple more omelet makers, I think, to time it.
Yeah, right.
Because usually I've only seen there's like one.
And that's always
and
the
line,
case.
You know? Yeah. It's always a line.
It like, seems like a horrible
job. Why not just put another one out there?
Well, let's math this out a little bit. How long does it take to make an omelet?
A couple minutes.
Yeah, 4 minutes maybe.
So just four minutes. What about a waffle?
Depends. So you mentioned fear before, and I want to touch on that one thing.
Yeah.
Our waffle, it is sort of the bane of our existence down at Sardine on our Sundays. It can make or break a brunch, and it has where it will just not work properly. It won't heat up. It breaks down. But there is a little fear in our waffle maker. Yeah. It's the best and worst of things down there. Yeah. But
about 2 minutes, maybe.
On a waffle, when it's a couple minutes.
Okay, so the waffle person should go first. No. The omelet person should go first by a couple minutes, and then the waffle person should go get the waffle.
But on a buffet, usually that omelet maker is like 100 yards away from the rest of the buffet, from my experience.
I would say make sure he's first in line to order.
Well, we're talking brunch right now for Food Friday. We've got John Gatto and Philip Hurley, chefs and co-owners of Sardine and Marigold Kitchen in Madison. So if someone's a home chef, they want to do a nice brunch. Can you just sort of lay out a sample menu for us that a home chef could easily pull together?
Yeah, go ahead.
All
right. I think you want some fruit in there, and so sometimes the brunch just about it. What's complicated is timing, and it's harder for the home chef. It's a little bit easier for us to whip things together. So you can do things ahead. A breakfast casserole. That could be done a strata or something like that. Could be made the night before.
Totally.
You've got your if you want to do some potato dish, that's cut up the night before, ready to go. And so all you have to do is toss some olive oil and seasoning and throw it in the oven. So you think about those elements.
Yeah, and a great salad, you know, and some great bread. And, you could have, make your own Bloody Mary deal or have some great brunch cocktails, fresh fruit.
The hard thing at a brunch at home, I think, is doing pancakes, doing waffles, because now you're stuck doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
The party's happening, and you're bringing out a couple at a time, and it doesn't really play in.
Is there a solution for that? Do you stick them in the oven? That's what we do, but then they kind of lose a little sunshine.
All the love goes out of them when you put them in the oven. Right?
I mean, you could make a nice coffee cake or something
exactly.
And then you've got the egg dish that you're baking off and bringing out at the same time. That's...
I think a key, so easy, is a green salad, and people appreciate it when you have rich, having sausage. You don't have to just do a normal link. You could do a mixture of bratwurst and Dewey, some Italian sausage. Again, those are things that can be put in the oven, already ready to go.
So don't skip the salad.
Don't skip the salad.
Yeah. Well, guys, thank you so much. It's been fun.
Thank you. Enjoyed being here.
Talking there with John Gatto and Philip Hurley, chefs and co-owners of Marigold and Sardine. They're two brunch places in Madison. And don't forget, we've got a couple of those recipes up on the Central Time Facebook page, a salmon sandwich with egg and some capers, some other good stuff, and also creamed eggs.
Couple of phrases you won't hear together very often: Neil deGrasse Tyson and rap battle.
But that's what's been happening this week. The rapper Bob, spelled B-O-B, has been publicizing his belief that the Earth is flat, and this week he posted his globe denialist arguments on social media.
Astrophysicist Tyson, he's a big popularizer of science, and he couldn't let that go, so he responded with evidence of the generally, spherical shape of our planet. Bob, the rapper, responded with a diss track called Flatline, targeting Tyson.
And if you can believe it, things escalated into a musical response from Tyson called Flat to Fact.
Flat Earth is a problem only when people in charge think that way. No law stops you from regressively basking in it.
He learned the game from Carl Sagan. You can never check him. You say the Earth is flat and then you try to disrespect him. I'm bringing facts.
That's not, by the way, Neil deGrasse Tyson rapping there. He talked through the intro, but he let his nephew take over the rapping chores. Evidently, as a rapper, he's a pretty good astrophysicist.
And you got to say, these are things that Einstein did not have to deal with.
No Twitter wars, yeah.
Maybe he would have enjoyed the chance to rap. I would have loved to hear Einstein rap.
I think there's got to be an Einstein, recreation society that if you're out there, let us know. Get in touch with us. Give us the Einstein rap. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.